Well, I'm really stunned by it. I mean, it's just such a wonderful event for any writer to have a book recognized like this. And I guess the thing that I like the most, in a way, is that it kind of verifies the South Dakota and North Dakotan standing as people who buck the trends, because most books published in America these days only stay in print for a couple of years. And this book has been in print now for 20 years, and here South Dakota is saying, "Hey, we're gonna take a look at this book again." It just amazes me, really, that it's happening, and I'm very honored. Of course, it's just it's a thrill for me. And one of the weird things, because you live in Hawaii, you can drive around the island. You can't drive around any of the islands. There's always at least one impassable cliff or something like that. But you can drive around, you have to go make a lot of circles to go 200 miles. And when I'm touring in the Dakotas, almost all the towns are mostly between 150 and 200 miles apart. So I'm going to get a real road trip, which for someone who's living in Honolulu is a thrill. if I drove 200 miles out of Honolulu, I'd end up in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So.
What's it like for you to go back and look at this book, Dakota, some of which was written back in the 1980s?
Yeah, most of it was actually, I began it probably at about 1983, and the first part of it that was published actually appeared in the North Dakota Quarterly, I think, in 1985. So it is old, and I know that some things have changed. I think one of the things that's going to be interesting for me taking in when I'm there, and also I'm really interested in the discussions that I can have with audiences about what things have changed and what things haven't changed. Obviously, in western North Dakota, they've got that terrific oil boom and gas exploration boom that's going on. And I actually worked in western North Dakota during the oil boom of the early 1980s. I was up in Williston and some of those western Dakota towns, and it was crazy. And then it died down almost completely. And everybody tells me that this is a much more massive scale. I suspect that small towns haven't changed that much, in the sense that people still love to gossip. They think they know more about you than they really do, and that some of the tensions between people who are considered insiders and outsiders, because probably haven't changed all that much, just because small towns tend to be the same everywhere. But I'll be interested to learn, what has changed and what hasn't.
Well, let's go back to what brought you to Lemon in the 1970s. At that time, when this book came out, you'd been living there for what, about 20 years after coming to Lemon from New York, where you were living?
Actually, when I began writing the book, I'd been living there 10 years. We moved there in 1974 in the early spring.
You and your husband, David Dwyer.
Yeah, I decided that I had left my job in New York in January of 74, but I decided it probably wasn't the best thing to try to move my husband to South Dakota in January. He was from the New York City area and was really interested and ended up loving the place, but I just thought introducing him in January might not be the best idea. So we waited until the spring, and we actually had a rainy spring that year. It was actually kind of lovely, and the lilac bushes that my grandmother had planted were in bloom, and when we got to the house, things like that. It was a very lovely, for me, it felt kind of like a homecoming, because I had spent so much of my childhood in that house.
This is your grandmother,
yeah,
Totten's house.
But actually, my roots in the Dakotas go really very far back, because I had an ancestor who was a stagecoach driver on the stage line that went from Deadwood to Bismarck. So I've got some very early history. And then my mother was born and raised in Lemon, of course, and my father was 3 when he moved to South Dakota. His father was a Methodist pastor. They came up from West Virginia. And my father lived in something like 9 or 10 towns all over South Dakota. He graduated from high school in Murdo in 1935, but they were in the East River. They were in DeSmet and Colombe and Salem, Hot Springs, Faith, and Murdo. I mean, so he grew up all over South Dakota. So I had these. In fact, his parents are buried up in Webster, because that was his father's last church in South Dakota. So I have all these roots that were there, and we did spend, my family, my mom and my brother and my sisters, and I did spend a lot of our childhood, you know, up in Lemmon, so it felt like a familiar place to me, but of course I'd never lived there full time. When my grandparents died, I guess the normal thing would have been for my mother to sell that house in town and also to sell the farm interests, at the ranch land and stuff that my grandfather had had for years out by Morristown. But, you know, she felt a real strong emotional attachment to the place. And my job in New York was kind of at a dead end, and I just said, well, why don't we move out there, and we can stay out there, and it'll be a good place to write. And, you know, we had these half-baked ideas, but, you know, we'll do this until you decide what you want to do. And basically she never had to decide because we lived there for 25 years, and events kind of eventually decided, made us decide that we had to leave. It was mainly my husband's health, but yeah, it was kind of a crazy story, but it just, you know, lots of times when you look back at events in your life, you think, this sounds really crazy, but it made sense at the time.
What do you think your experience living elsewhere then contributed to your understanding and appreciation of life in Lebanon, South Dakota? Did that allow you to see some of the contradictions that people who've never lived elsewhere can't see? You know, like the attitude that you write about in Dakota, that nothing ever changes, but in reality, things are always changing in small towns.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I very quickly learned, because I really love New York City, and in fact, I must be a very confused person, because the three places I feel most at home are Manhattan and New York City, Lemmon, South Dakota, and Honolulu.
Three very different places.
Very different places, but especially moving from New York, and I learned to value Lemmon, South Dakota, and the whole West River and all of that for being the way it was, and not to miss what I really did miss about New York and say, no, this place has its own values. It's I can understand why people want to live here, why people love living here. I understand why people love living in New York City, and it was very helpful to have that perspective. And it was kind of funny because sometimes when people would move to town, to Lemmon, like a doctor or a pastor or a teacher, and I would hear them start whining about, well, why can't Lemmon be more like Minneapolis? I would say, you won't make it here if that's what your attitude is. You should go back to Minneapolis. I mean, if you want to try to, if you're upset about why Lemmon isn't more like Minneapolis, then go to Minneapolis. But I think I learned to appreciate the place in a really, really deep way, and I was glad about that. It made me happy, and I also, you know, it made me happy to go back to New York and say, gee, this isn't like Lemmon, and isn't that great? You know, and I could visit New York and have a good time. And there are things I miss. People might have a hard time believing it, but there are certainly things I miss about Lemmon when I'm in Honolulu. Because Honolulu is a city, it's a fairly noisy city in terms of traffic noise and all that kind of stuff. And when I get out to Lemmon, it just seems so quiet. And I get a much better view of the sky. I appreciate Honolulu a lot in January because I know what January in South Dakota is like. So, I mean, it's just that kind of perspective. You value a place for being the way it is.
Do you think the people that live in places like Lemmon, South Dakota, and other more isolated places can appreciate the things that you're talking about, just being able to see the sky, the quiet, appreciate them the same way that people like you, Kathleen Norris, who've lived elsewhere, lived in New York City and Honolulu?
I don't know. I mean, I think you'd have to ask them, I guess, in a way. I mean, obviously, the people who live on a ranch, say, near Kelvin, South Dakota and stuff, if that's the only thing they've ever known, I mean, they know why they like it, but it might make visiting a city harder for them because they would have a really hard time seeing what's valuable there. In fact, I know people that there's a family that lived across the street from me in Lemmon, and their daughter now lives and loves New York City, and I think they kind of blame me for that. I had nothing to do with it, but you know, she ended up living in New York, and when they go, they just hate it. They have a really hard time visiting. So it's hard. But one thing, there are a lot of really weird similarities. In fact, this is something I may end up writing a little bit about, similarities between, say, a place like Lemmon, South Dakota, and Honolulu, and when I'm with people who've never really left South Dakota, or I'm with people who've really never left Hawaii, they can have the same, exactly the same kind of insular attitude, that they really are afraid of anything different and other, and it can be a very provincial, a very self-limiting attitude. If they want to be a big fish in a very small pond, Honolulu works really well, and so does Lemon, South Dakota. But it that attitude can often make you resist and even fear the larger world. And people, I think, really do shortchange themselves when that's what they hold to, if that's the thing they're clinging to.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Kathleen Norris. Her book, Dakota, A Spiritual Geography, is the 2014 North and South Dakota One Book Selection. And the book, Kathleen Norris, is subtitled A Spiritual Geography, and you write about how moving to Lemon brought you back to your Christian heritage. And how did that happen, and did that surprise you?
I guess it surprised me, although in retrospect it seems pretty logical. I mean, my grandparents literally had donated the land for the Spencer Memorial Presbyterian Church. It's only about three houses down from my grandparents' house. It's a place where my mother actually had a horse on that lot when she was a girl. So they donated the land for the church. They were members of the church for over 60 years. So it was a big part of their life, and I used to go with them when I would visit in the summers. But I just sort of drifted away, and I kind of drifted back, I guess, to Christianity. I started going to that church partly because I knew a lot of the people there, and it was almost a kind of nostalgic reason. But then I began to realize, and I was in my early 30s, and I began to realize, no, I really needed this, that there was something about this religion that really was part of not only my roots, but really who I was. And so I was fortunate enough to get to know a number of the pastors, not only in that church, but the other pastors in town, and that helped me kind of understand the Christian faith in a deeper way, to learn more about it. And one of the pastors said a line that ended up in the book, and I just love it. Lemon is such a small town that the poets and the pastors have to hang out together.
It doesn't happen in New York City.
Doesn't necessarily happen in a big city.
And soon you started preaching as well, wasn't it? The thought was that, well, you're a writer, so you can preach too.
Oh yeah, in fact I love to really terrify other writers when I tell them that story, because it was just Alice Maine, a lovely, lovely woman who still lives in Lemon, and she was the head of the worship committee, and we were between pastors, and she just looked at me, and well, it was partly they knew my grandmother, and my grandmother did good Bible studies. And so they knew that I must have inherited that, right? So I could do good Bible studies. And then they knew I was a writer. And she literally said, well, you're a writer. You can preach. And I'm just going, this is so crazy. But I did it. For about 9 months, I preached one or two sermons a month. It was great training as a writer. You get to play with the Bible in a really serious, wonderful way. I really enjoyed it. I get to do it now a couple times a year at different places. I don't do it very often anymore. And then, of course, it was funny for me because I have so many pastors in my ancestry, both my Methodist grandfather and great-grandfather, who was a circuit rider in West Virginia. But my ancestry in terms of ministry goes all the way back to the 16th century in England. So, I mean, it was really like Alice didn't know this, but she was really tapping into a very deep, deep history in my family. And my brother is a pastor, and his wife, he's a United Church of Christ pastor, and his wife is an Episcopal priest. So it's kind of one of those family things. I thought I had avoided it, but then it turned out I hadn't.
Do you think you would have rediscovered that heritage, your Christian heritage, if you hadn't moved to Lemon?
I think it might have taken longer. It might have taken a different form. And, of course, the ironic thing is that I was living in Manhattan, and there are churches on almost every street corner in Manhattan, all kinds of churches, you know, Orthodox, there's synagogues, there's temples, there's cathedrals, there's all these churches, and I basically hardly ever thought to go to one. And here I moved to Lemon, South Dakota, and that's one of the first things I did. So it's kind of a weird, kind of a funny story, really.
part of Dakota, a spiritual geography, and later works of yours as well, like the cloister walk. There's quite a bit that you write about your visits to monasteries and how important that is. Is there any connection between the experiences in monasteries and the broader experiences of life in places like Lemon, South Dakota?
Well, you know, it took me about 10 years to discover the Benedictines, and it turns out that Dakotas have a lot of Benedictines. Most of them were founded out of monasteries in Europe and then the East Coast, and they moved west, and so there's communities, men's and women's communities in Richardson, North Dakota. There's a women's community in Bismarck. And so discovering these people and their hospitality and their willingness to loan me books from their wonderful libraries, it really did help me in terms of understanding sort of the deeper roots of my Christian faith, that you know, the Christian faith didn't start with the Reformation, which I come from a Protestant background. It started in the second century, and in the third and fourth century, you start having this movement we now call monasticism of people living in small communities and praying together and working together and all of that. And so it was really, it really helped me along with my, you know, sort of grounding in my Christian faith. And I guess monasteries in a way are like small towns, and they have some of the same problems that small towns have, on an even more intense level, because they're really spending all their time together. And it was just interesting to me that how much I began to learn from them, not only about the Christian faith, but about how communities work and how people can learn to live together in a relatively peaceable way, even in very close quarters.
If you were to go back and visit yourself back in the early 70s when you were in New York City, would you be surprised to then find out that you would become fairly well known as a spiritual writer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was not, I mean, poetry, I was writing poetry then. I published my first book, actually, in 1971 when I was living in New York City. I think there is a spiritual element to poetry in the process of writing, and kind of you're getting in touch with deeper realities than just like when you're, you know, writing checks and paying the bills. There's something spiritual about writing itself, and particularly poetry. But I never would have seen myself as preaching or writing about the Bible or any of that. That was, I never really saw myself as even writing prose. So that was a surprise, too.
Do you write much poetry anymore?
It comes and goes. If I'm really concentrating on prose, the poetry tends to get kind of pushed to the side. And I do have a few poems I'm working on. It's not a lot, but it's a few that I like, and I've been working on them. I don't have a book of poems in mind, but when I began to see the effects of the farm crisis, like in the early 80s, that was really the genesis of the book Dakota. I realized that there were so many stories from the Dakotas, among them, you know, being the farm crisis and what I was seeing happening in the institutions in these small towns, like churches and schools and medical clinics, that all rely on outsiders, you know, to come in and work there and stuff. I was seeing all this turmoil, and I realized that my little lyric poetry really couldn't handle it. The subject was just too big. And so that's when I started writing essays about that turned into the book Dakota.
You mentioned the outsiders. Even though you had the family background in Lemon, South Dakota, you hadn't lived there. Were you seen as when you first moved to Lemon as something of an outsider, despite your family background?
You know, it was a wonderful combination of being an outsider and an insider, because I knew the older generation. I knew my grandparents' generation very well, and I'd known them all my life, and I kept in touch with them. And then I knew the kids I had grown learning to swim in the pool in Lemon, the kids I'd spent summers with. So I had these insider connections, and of course my grandfather had been a doctor there for 55 years. You know, people still, I think probably people still call that house the Totten House, because they lived, you know, they built it in the 20s and lived there for so many years. And of course I was an outsider. because I'd grown up, went to high school in Hawaii, and I'd lived in New York City, and so it was this wonderful combination, and I think it really made it possible for me to write about the place. Probably if I had grown up in Lemon and stayed there and never left, it never would occur to me to write about it, the way I did anyway. And so it was a nice combination. And what really pleased me was the way my husband was accepted. We faced a lot of weird rumors that he was a federal narcotics agent or he was a drug dealer. They contradicted each other, but nobody cared. I mean, those two rumors were floating around. Because why would anybody from New York City come to Lemon? Crazy, crazy rumors. But David was a really sweet guy, and just he was a very good bartender, so he was in demand. He was a good computer programmer. When computers came out, the high school hired him to do their first computerized list of graduates and alumni and stuff. And he just fit right in, and so he became so accepted, in fact, that he was elected to two terms on the city council, and a whole bunch of people wanted him to run for mayor, but he decided that he'd rather write, you know, he'd rather be right than have all that responsibility. But yeah, he served two terms on the city council and helped write the new sewer ordinance and crazy things like that. So it was, we were obviously outsiders. We had all these outside connections. David's family was all from the East Coast, but we were also insiders and treated as insiders at some level as well. And I used to watch, you know, because I worked at the public library in Lemon for a long time, and I would watch people come into town to work, and from places like New Jersey or even Minneapolis or Chicago. And I got really good at spotting which people would just be totally lost. They really wouldn't know where they had landed, and they wouldn't stay long. I got good at spotting that because it really became pretty obvious. And if they married somebody local, well, that was a whole new step. But often these people would only stay in town for two or three years and just move on.
What was it that you think they had difficulties with that they couldn't stay very long?
I guess not really noticing what was different about this place from, say, any place else they'd ever lived. The physical isolation of the place makes a huge difference. The basically tromping on sort of cherished attitudes and mores and all of those things in the small town without even knowing they were doing it. Just being kind of, you know, like a bull in a china shop. But there were some sad examples, too, of people who really did like the place and really would have loved to have stayed longer. But during the farm crisis especially, we're kind of scapegoated. And the real problems, say, in a church congregation are usually within the congregation itself, but a lot of them will tend to blame the pastor for any problems they have and kick the pastor out, and they keep doing this over and over and over again. And there's a lot of churches in the Western Plains that you could look to see that they've had their pastors for two or three years each. Starting from the 1920s on, hardly anybody would stay there longer than two or three years. And so that you get these patterns built up, and that's what people expect, and that's what they know how to do. And so you get that of course contributes to instability in the long run. It hurts these small town institutions, but sometimes it takes a really long time for people to recognize that. I mean, it's always harder to face your own problems and say, this is a problem that we have or I have, than to just say, well, somebody else must be causing this.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Kathleen Norris about her book, Dakota, Spiritual Geography. It's the 2014 North and South Dakota One Book Selection. And this book was published in 1993. And I'm wondering, at the time when this book came out, what the reaction was to what you wrote by people in Lemon, the people that you knew, people that lived there.
Well, you know, 10 years after the book came out, Houghton Mifflin asked me to do an introduction. They wanted to bring out a new edition with a little preface, and that was one of the things they asked me, would you write about that? And I said, I would love to, because it perfectly illustrated so much of what I had said in the book, that the first reviews appeared in Boston and San Francisco, which astonished my publisher, because they thought it would only get reviewed on the Great Plains or places maybe in Chicago or Denver. And all of a sudden it was getting reviewed on the East and West Coast, and getting good reviews. And then what happened in Lemon was I was on a book tour. I was traveling, and I got a phone call from a friend who said, what have you done? People here are just so upset about this book you've written. And I said, why? And then she said she'd gone to some little coffee group, you know, ladies having coffee and gossiping, and she had to laugh because people were just so upset about I had named names and I told all these stories, and people just were put on the spot. And then it turned out no one had actually read the book because it hadn't come to Lemon yet. It was people had their relatives in, say, Seattle or San Francisco or something, had read a review and talked about it. Have you heard about this book? So it completely proved what I say about gossip, is that so much of it is just baseless. And my friend thought that too. She said, well, why don't we actually wait till we see the book? And then once people got a hold of the book, they realized that I hadn't named names. I hadn't put people on the spot. I hadn't really, I mean, there were probably a couple people that were recognizable, but I really had changed a lot of details that didn't matter in the long run, but that wouldn't put people on the spot, because that's not why I would write a book. So when the book came out, it got the same response that those early essays had gotten, like in the North Dakota Quarterly essay had gotten. Some people absolutely loved it. Other people absolutely hated it. And, of course, as a writer, I think that means I'm doing something right. If you get a strong reaction, either positive or negative, or both strong and negative, then you realize you've hit a nerve and you're on to something. And so it was, a lot of people say, yeah, she's really telling it like it is. This is how it is in a small town, to people saying, well, if she doesn't like it here, she should leave. And those are valid responses. It was fascinating to me to see that. But then over time, what happened in Lemon was really great, because now the Chamber of Commerce sells it. They're promoting it. They're happy to have their name on the map. And I remember I got some calls. I talked to some people who'd been to a business conference someplace, I think in Chicago. And when they said they were from Lemon, South Dakota, they said, oh, do you know this lady? She wrote this book. And it was the first time that anybody had ever heard of Lemon. So they realized, gee, you know, she's kind of put us on the map here. This might not be all bad. But it's been a really interesting, the reactions have always run the gamut, from very, very negative to very, very positive. And I'm happy with that, actually.
Now, the book, Dakota, has been in print 20 years. And as you mentioned, when it first came out, it was getting reviewed in Boston and elsewhere. What do you think it is about this book that resonated with readers around the country, many of whom had never been to Lemon, South Dakota, didn't know anything about life in this part of the world? What it was that resonated then and still does, that this book continues to be read today?
Well, it was a big surprise, you know, to me and my publisher, but I think it boils down to something one of the editors said. She was a woman working in New York City with the publisher, but she'd been born and raised in a small town in New Hampshire, and she said, you've described my small town perfectly. And so when I started getting wonderful letters from people, not just from the Great Plains, but all over the country, saying, you've described where I grew up, and it could be any place. And one of the most interesting letters I received was from a pastor in Los Angeles who said, you've helped me understand the older generation in my church, because most of them were descendants of people who had moved from South Dakota in the 20s and 30s during the Depression. And it settled in Los Angeles because the jobs were there, but they still carried a lot of the attitudes and a lot of the history that I had described. And so I was getting all these wonderful letters. In fact, one thing I'd like to mention is that all those letters now are at the South Dakota State University. They're in their archives. I've got an archive collection that we've started a few years ago, and I decided that it was better to put those letters in a safe place where other people could get a look at them. I got a beautiful handwritten note from George McGovern, too, that I really treasure.
I'm wondering if one of the things that makes Dakota so resonant, one of the reasons why people still read the book and get something out of it, is that really what you're writing about is community, and this is something that you touched on earlier, that community is, whether it's in a monastery, whether it's in Honolulu or New York City, that behavior in communities, it's the same everywhere.
It really is, in a sense. And then you have communities that are under pressure, you know, like with something like a farm crisis, a lot of the more negative things will come to the fore, and people have to struggle with them. And I think it helps people, if you're reading a book, it helps to understand, wait a minute, this problem didn't start with me and my community. These are the kinds of problems communities always have been dealing with, and particularly like on the Great Plains. And you certainly would see that now with oil and gas exploration ramping up in the Dakotas, all kinds of pressures that are very hard for small towns to deal with. And, you know, so I hope the book can be helpful in that sense, to let people know, no, you're not alone in this. This is something that human beings have to contend with.
One of the things that you wrote about in Dakota also was the people here not valuing their own stories. I'm wondering if you think that perhaps the success of Dakota helped change that at all, if you've seen any difference over the past 20 years, that maybe now people from South Dakota, North Dakota, and in this region maybe starting to see that maybe the stories that we have here are worthwhile telling.
Well, I hope so, and that's something I want to explore when I'm there, you know, to find out from people if they are writing their own life stories and things. Some of the most moving letters I received were from people whose parents lived in the like western Nebraska, say, and a woman writing me and saying, you know, I'm giving your book to my mother because I really want her to tell me her stories, but she doesn't think they're important. She had grown up like my mother in the Depression in the 20s and 30s and all of that. And so already people were beginning to do that. And another really great response I got was from the late Jim Nelson, who was the editor of the Timberlake Topic, which is a really great newspaper. Well, he grew up in Lemon. In fact, I knew his dad because his father used to come to the library where I worked there. And he wrote me a really thoughtful response about the things he liked about the book and the things he didn't like about the book, where he thought my perspective was wrong. And I said, of course my perspective's wrong, because I wasn't born and raised in Lemon. But I said, what your letter is telling me is that you need to write your own book. You really should write your own book on this. And I don't think he ever did. He did write, you know, for the newspaper for years, and I know he did a lot of research in the local paleontology, fossils, and things like that. I sure hope so, because wherever people are, there are stories and interesting stories. And the rest of the world, frankly, tells South Dakota that their stories aren't worth much. You know, I think Newsweek referred to us as America's empty quarter. They were referring to basically the northwestern Great Plains. And so we get told that our stories aren't worth much. Movies and television don't reflect the people we know, very rarely. So it's hard to believe that, but I'm hoping that a book like Dakota can push people along, saying, no, what happens here is important.
For you personally, Kathleen Norris, how important was the success of Dakota? It, of course, led to other books, The Cloister Walk, Amazing Grace, CD and Me, and others.
Oh, I mean, it didn't change my life outwardly. I had to stop answering the phone, but that was probably the major thing. But, you know, it was wonderful because I was living in a small town, and the rest of my time I was spent in monasteries. So nobody was much impressed with the fact that I had a book on the New York Times bestseller list. It didn't matter. And that was a real blessing for me as a writer, because it meant I could just keep working and didn't have to deal with the craziness I would have had to deal with, say, if all of this had happened to me when I was living in New York City. In fact, my agent in New York told me, you don't know how lucky you are. And I said, oh, I do know. I really appreciate that. So my outward life didn't change. And I guess the main thing was that it made it possible, the success of Dakota made it much easier for me to write and publish the other books as they came along. And working with one particular editor over the years was a real blessing, too. And then, you know, we had the money to buy my husband and I had the money to buy our first new car. That was a big deal. I tend to be a little bit conservative, like my grandfather Totten and Lemon, and basically the extra money that came in, a lot of it was just put into savings and, you know, saved for later.
20 years later, do you still enjoy talking about this book, Dakota?
Well, I still get fan letters from people who have just discovered it. I probably get a couple of months. Now, when the book first came out, it was like, you know, lots and lots of letters. But I still get fan letters from people all over who have just discovered the book. I think my favorite came from a missionary in Egypt. Of course, she was living in a real desert, but she said the perspective it gave her on small communities really helped her in her work as a missionary in Egypt. And I just thought, well, who knew, you know, that a book about Western Dakota could do this? I mean, it's crazy. But I haven't really had the opportunity to talk about it very much. I was asked to do the South Dakota State University commencement address last year, and that was really fun. So I was able to talk about it a little bit there with their students. So this is going to be just like a big ice cream sundae for me, you know, with chocolate and cherries on top, because it's like I haven't really been able to talk about it and really revisit the book and revisit the region. I mean, it's like a writer's dream come true.
How often do you get back to South Dakota?
I try to come once a year, and every year I have a list of things I want to do. I'm trying to empty the house there because my youngest sister really wants it, and I need to get the furniture. My grandparents' furniture is almost all still there, but I'm trying to get a lot of my things out. And so every year lately I've been sending stuff to South Dakota State University, donating bags and bags of clothes to thrift shops, or sometimes giving things to my nieces and nephew that I think they might enjoy from the house. So I every year, and then I basically, the water's turned off, so I stay with neighbors and just, you know, get to revisit everybody, go back to the library there has had a couple of receptions for me just to meet and greet people when I come to town. So it's been kind of fun that way. But I can't, it's just the way my life is and everything, I haven't been able to spend a lot of time there anymore.